minutes later by the crash of a fourth flight into a field about 70 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It appeared passengers aboard the fourth plane, having learned of the fate of the other three through cell phone calls, confronted the hijackers before the plane could reach its intended target, which was believed to have been the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Remember, the United States had suffered the worst attack on its soil in its history, and the country plunged into a war against terrorism. Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The attacks, carried out by 19 members of a fundamentalist Islamic group called Al-Qaeda, the base, killed a total of 3,000 people, including 415 New York City police and firefighters who responded to the disaster at the World Trade Center. More than 6,000 people were injured. Americans and much of the rest of the world were shocked. Millions watched horrified as TV cameras that had been focusing on the North Tower after the first attack captured the second plane hitting the South Tower. The subsequent collapse of the towers was also carried live. National, state, and local officials scrambled to prepare for more attacks. Air travel was shut down. Stock markets in the United States and around the world were badly shaken and posted severe losses. On September 17th, President Bush formally identified Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden as the mastermind behind the attacks. A wealthy member of a prominent Saudi Arabian family, bin Laden had operated out of Afghanistan since the mid-1990s under the protection of a group called the Taliban. The Taliban, which means student, followed an extreme version of Islamic law and had seized control in Afghanistan in 1998. Taking on the Taliban. Speaking to a joint session of Congress on September 20th, Bush demanded the Taliban hand over bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda leaders and dismantle terrorist training camps within Afghanistan. They will hand over the terrorists or share their fate, Bush warned. On October 7th, after Taliban leaders had rejected Bush's demands, U.S. and British aircraft unleashed a massive bombing attack on major Afghan cities. By mid-November, the Afghan capital of Kabul had fallen. By mid-December, air attacks coupled with allied nations' ground forces that included about 30,000 troops from the United States and anti-Taliban Afghan militia had toppled the Taliban regime. While out of power, the Taliban was not out of business. After a year of licking their wounds, Taliban forces began an insurgency. Their efforts were fueled by funds from control of much of Afghan's vast production of poppies, from which opium was manufactured. It was the nation's largest cash crop, providing most of the world's opium and 400,000 Afghans with work. The enemy also took advantage of safe havens in mountainous areas along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border by scampering into Pakistan, where it was logistically and politically difficult for U.S. troops to follow. President Barack Obama, Bush's successor, countered in 2009 by gradually building U.S. forces to more than 100,000, while warning that our troop commitment in Afghanistan cannot be open-ended. By mid-2013, U.S. forces were down to 65,000, and by the end of 2016, 8,400. The number climbed to 14,000 by mid-2018 under President Donald Trump, however, with no indication that a complete withdrawal would happen in the foreseeable future. Bin Laden was killed by Navy SEALs in his Pakistan hiding place in May 2011, and Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar died 2 years later, apparently of tuberculosis. But after suffering more than 2,300 military deaths, spending at least $1 trillion, and fighting for three times longer than it had in World War II, the prognosis for peace in Afghanistan remained, at best, uncertain. Fighting terrorism on the home front. The Bush administration never formally declared war on Afghanistan, which allowed it to claim it didn't have to treat those captured as prisoners of war. But it did declare war on terrorism, and Bush proclaimed the war would continue and be fought on every front until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Remember, a month after the 9/11 attacks, as they came to be known, Bush proposed something called the Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act, or the USA Patriot Act. The far-reaching temporary act, most of which was made permanent by Congress in 2006, greatly expanded the authority of the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to conduct searches, look at medical and other personal records, such as what materials an individual took out from the public libraries, and spy without court approval on those suspected of potential terrorist acts. It also allowed foreigners to be held for up to 7 days without charges or deportation proceedings. The act was approved 357-66 in the House of Representatives. In the Senate, the vote was 98-1, with only Senator Russell Feingold, Democrat, Wisconsin, opposed. In July 2002, Bush secretly authorized the National Security Agency, NSA, to listen in on phone calls American citizens made to other countries and to monitor emails. See Chapter 25 for more on the NSA and electronic surveillance. The order wasn't made public until 2005, and Congress didn't sanction the actions until 2008. In November, Bush signed a bill creating the Department of Homeland Security, consolidating dozens of government agencies, from the Secret Service to the Coast Guard, into one super agency. Terrorism with a stamp on it. If the events of September 11th weren't enough to stamp the word terrorism firmly in the minds of Americans, some letters postmarked September 18th from Trenton, New Jersey, finished the job. The letters, to NBC News and the New York Post, contained a note bearing the date 9/11/01 and a short note. They also contained spores of anthrax, a nasty bacterial disease. Similar letters were apparently received at ABC News and CBS News in New York and the National Enquirer in Boca Raton, Florida, because people at those organizations were also exposed to anthrax. A few weeks later, anthrax-bearing letters addressed to U.S. Senators Tom Daschle of South Dakota and Patrick Leahy of Vermont were found. By the end of November, 22 people who either worked at the targeted sites or worked for the Postal Service had contracted the disease. 5 of them died. Americans became nervous about something as mundane as opening the mail. Government officials issued dozens of warnings, while emergency personnel practiced responding to any bioterrorism and chemical attacks. In late July 2008, Bruce E. Ivins, a longtime researcher at the Federal Biodefense Lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland, committed suicide. Within a week, federal prosecutors announced Ivins was the man behind the attacks and had acted alone. Some of Ivins' colleagues, however, doubted he had done it, and no convincing motive was established. The attacks remain ample fodder for conspiracy theorists everywhere. Imprisoning non-POWs at Guantanamo Bay. Because America had not actually declared war against Afghanistan, it didn't treat captured al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters as prisoners of war, POWs. Instead, they were taken to a prison erected on the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay on the island of Cuba. Administration officials contended that because the prison wasn't on U.S. soil, the prisoners had no rights and could be held indefinitely without trial or even formal charges being filed. Remember, in 2004, international observers reported some of the detainees at Guantanamo had been subjected to what the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques, which the observers characterized as tantamount to torture. One such technique, called waterboarding, consisted of covering a person's face with a towel and then pouring water over it, creating a sensation like drowning. It was also revealed that the CIA had abducted suspected terrorists and held them in secret prisons in Europe. Defending controversial tactics. Civil libertarians complained that such actions were counter to American ideals and violated basic human rights. But administration officials, notably Vice President Dick Cheney, defended the practices as justifiable and necessary to fight terrorism. They also pointed out that no terrorist attacks had occurred on U.S. soil since September 11th, while several terrorist plots had been sniffed out and stopped. In 2008, Congress approved a bill to ban some of the interrogation methods used, but Bush vetoed it. Of the 780 people held at the detention camp, most were eventually released without charges being filed or repatriated to other countries. When Bush left office, an estimated 242 prisoners were still at Guantanamo. His successor, Barack Obama, had promised during his campaign to close the base and repeated variations of the pledge in subsequent years. Shortly after taking office in January 2009, he signed an executive order closing down the CIA's secret prisons in other countries. But Congress repeatedly blocked efforts to completely close Guantanamo, and as of late 2018, 40 prisoners still remained there. That damn Saddam. With his approval ratings as high as 90% in some polls after the 9/11 attacks and U.S. retaliation in Afghanistan, Bush made the war on terror the centerpiece of his administration's efforts. And with the overthrow of the Taliban at least temporarily accomplished, the administration turned its attention to an old nemesis, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The United States, under the first President Bush, had decided in 1991 not to prolong the Gulf War by seeking Saddam's ouster. But it did persuade the United States to impose economic sanctions against Iraq, as well as to monitor the country's clandestine development of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, known collectively as Weapons of Mass Destruction, WMD. In 1998, after Iraqi officials had consistently interfered with UN inspectors, President Clinton ordered the bombing of several Iraqi military installations. Iraq countered by banning the UN inspectors. Moreover, the impact of economic sanctions had waned as some countries quietly resumed trading goods for Iraqi oil. Toughening the stance against Iraq. In 2002, the second President Bush began demanding that the UN toughen its dealings with Iraq. Bush argued that the Iraqis had, or were close to having, weapons of mass destruction. Further, he said, they were harboring members of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group that had engineered the 9/11 attacks. On October 10th and 11th, Congress approved a resolution authorizing the use of military force against Iraq. The vote was 297 to 133 in the House and 77 to 23 in the Senate. On February 5, 2003, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell went before the U.N. Security Council to restate American claims about WMDs, displaying aerial photographs of purported chemical weapons sites and mobile nerve gas labs. "Ladies and gentlemen, these are sophisticated facilities," Powell said. "For example, they can produce anthrax and botulinum toxin. In fact, they can produce enough dry biological agent to kill thousands upon thousands of people." Powell was countered by UN inspectors who said they were again making progress with Iraq and had found no evidence of WMDs. On March 17, 2003, despite the objections of U.S. allies such as France and Germany, but with the backing of most of Congress, an undeterred Bush issued an ultimatum that gave Saddam 48 hours to resign and get out of Iraq. When he didn't, U.S. and British forces on March 20th launched air attacks on Iraqi targets, including a bunker in which Saddam was thought to be meeting with aides. The U.S. invasion. Within days, U.S. forces invaded from neighboring Kuwait. By April 9th, the Iraqi capital of Baghdad had fallen. Saddam's sons were killed, and Saddam went into hiding. He was captured in December and turned over to Iraqi authorities. On December 30, 2006, he was executed. The ongoing war. On May 1, Bush landed on a U.S. aircraft carrier off the coast of San Diego and declared an end to major combat. Standing in front of a large banner proclaiming, "Mission accomplished," Bush told the crew that, "Because of you, the target is fallen, and Iraq is free. The war on terror is not over, yet it is not endless. We do not know the day of final victory, but we have seen the turning of the tide." But if the tide had turned, it seemed to have turned the wrong way. The United States lacked a comprehensive post-war plan for rebuilding the country. Looting and riots dismantled much of Iraq's infrastructure and damaged public buildings. U.S. occupation leaders barred members of Saddam's Ba'ath Party from serving in the provisional government and largely disbanded the Iraqi army. That resulted in a dearth of experienced political leaders and military officers to help with the country's reconstruction. Remember, in the aftermath, guerrilla warfare caused far more casualties than the brief war had, and fighting between militias of the rival Islamic Sunni and Shiite sects threatened to plunge the country into civil war. Worse for Bush, an intensive search failed to turn up any weapons of mass destruction, and it became clear that Saddam had almost no connection with al-Qaeda. Losing popularity at home. At home, the war had quickly lost popularity after its initial successes had given way to a protracted fight. In 2004, Bush won re-election over U.S. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts by the narrowest margin of any incumbent president since Woodrow Wilson in 1916. In 2006, public dissatisfaction with the progress of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq helped Democrats wrest control of both houses of Congress for the first time since 1994. In January 2007, with no light visible at the end of the dark Iraqi tunnel, Bush announced he was sending in 21,500 more U.S. troops, for a total of 170,000, in an effort to quell the almost ceaseless violence in the country. It was called the Surge Strategy. He also announced renewed U.S. efforts to rebuild Iraq's infrastructure and economy. Although U.S. military deaths reached 907 in 2007, the highest of any year, they dropped to 284 in the first 10 months of 2008. While administration officials claimed the decline was proof the surge was working, critics contended it was due to the Shiite militia having largely defeated the Sunni and to insurgent forces adopting a strategy of waiting until U.S. forces began withdrawing. In February 2009, new President Barack Obama announced U.S. combat troops would pull out of Iraq by the end of August 2010, which they did. Thousands of American military advisors, however, remained for another year. On December 15, 2011, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta officially declared the war over. The 8-year war had cost the United States about 4,400 military personnel killed, more than 32,000 wounded, and at least $1 trillion. And the investment was by no means complete. By mid-2014, large areas of Iraq were under attack by a radical group calling itself the Islamic State. Also known as ISIS, the group used the guise of religious fundamentalism as an excuse to murder, rape, loot, vandalize, enslave, and terrorize much of the Middle East. At least 5,000 U.S. troops were redeployed to Iraq and helped Iraqi forces drive most ISIS fighters out of the country by the end of 2017. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world. As the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq dragged on, America was waging wars of words with other countries. In 2002, Bush had labeled Iran and North Korea, along with Iraq, as parts of an axis of evil. The primary beef with North Korea was the country's defiant insistence in developing its nuclear weapons program. After several years of public posturing and private negotiating, North Korea formally agreed in June 2008 to halt its program in return for the easing of economic sanctions against it. But the agreement didn't last. In April 2009, North Korea launched a rocket that was believed to be part of a test of the country's nuclear missile capabilities. Later that year, and again in 2013, North Korean leaders announced they had conducted successful nuclear tests. The announcements were surrounded by a flurry of bellicose threats of war against the United States and South Korea. At the center of the country's bellicosity was its dictator, 30-year-old Kim Jong-un, who assumed power after his father, Kim Jong-il, died in December 2011. The younger Kim, a ruthless despot who loved American basketball and routinely had people killed, including a brother and an uncle, when they crossed him, would prove to be every bit as much of a problem for the United States and the rest of the world as his father had. Iran was another thorny problem. Bush administration officials insisted Iran was aiding the insurgency in neighboring Iraq by arming the insurgents and was developing a nuclear weapons program that further threatened the already unstable region. Although evidence as to the exact status of the Iranian nuclear program was conflicting, the administration viewed Iran as a real threat to the region's stability. So did much of the rest of the world. In 2015, representatives of the United States, France, Britain, Russia, China, Germany, and the European Union negotiated a deal with Iranian leaders. If Iran would give up its nuclear aspirations, the other countries would ease financial sanctions against Iran that had crippled that nation's economy. Critics warned Iranian leaders could not be trusted to follow through on their end of the deal, and that sunset clauses in the agreement meant certain parts of the deal would expire in future years. That, critics argued, would at best only postpone, not end, Iran's nuclear aspirations. Oprah Winfrey. In nearly every field of human endeavor, there are individuals who are so dominant that they're instantly recognized just by their first name. In rock and roll, it's Elvis. In soccer, it's Pele. For nearly everything else, it's Oprah. Born in 1954 to an unwed teenage mother, Winfrey was raised in poverty by various relatives. Following college, Winfrey became host of a daytime TV talk show in Maryland and then moved to Chicago in 1984. From 1986 to 2011, she hosted a nationally syndicated program that launched her into a highly varied and highly lucrative career. Winfrey became an Academy Award-nominated actress, a movie and TV producer, a magazine publisher, an author, and an arbiter of America's popular tastes. All that made Winfrey a billionaire several times over and one of the world's most generous philanthropists. It's estimated that through 2013, she had given more than $400 million to various educational programs and raised or donated tens of millions more for other causes. She also became extremely influential. For example, she was once sued by Texas cattlemen for saying on her show that she wouldn't eat another hamburger because of mad cow disease. The cattlemen claimed her remarks drove down the price of beef. A Texas jury sided with Winfrey. In 2013, Forbes magazine named Winfrey the world's most powerful celebrity, and Vanity Fair magazine suggested she had more cultural influence than any politician or religious leader, except perhaps the Pope. Of course, he's known by his first name only too. Wins and losses. While the war on terrorism dominated Bush's presidency, he did attempt to make changes on domestic issues as well. In 2001, Bush proposed an ambitious education reform program called the No Child Left Behind Act. Approved by Congress, the plan boosted federal education funding, increased standards expected of schools, including annual reading and math skills testing, and gave parents more flexibility in choosing schools. The program was variously praised for making schools more accountable and criticized for forcing educators to take cookie-cutter approaches to teaching. After more than a decade of arguing about it, the program was replaced in 2015 by the Every Student Succeeds Act, which gave states more flexibility in setting standards for testing and measuring schools and the students' progress. In late 2003, Bush pushed a plan through Congress to reform Medicare, the federal health insurance program for the elderly. The plan gave senior citizens more choices when picking a private insurance plan through which they received medical services, as well as in obtaining prescription drugs. Bush had far less success in trying to reform Social Security and U.S. immigration policies. He proposed replacing the government-run pension program with a system of private savings accounts, but the plan died in the face of criticism that it would put too much of a burden on individuals and be too expensive in the transition. Bush also supported a bipartisan plan that would allow an estimated 12 million illegal immigrants to remain in the country on a temporary basis and to apply for citizenship after returning to their own countries and paying a fine. The plan was crushed by the weight of opposition from those who thought it was too draconian and those who thought it was too soft. But all the blustery rhetoric in Washington was like a gentle summer breeze when compared to a natural disaster that blew into the South. Big Blow in the Big Easy. On August 23, 2005, a hurricane formed over the Bahamas and headed toward the southeastern United States. Called Katrina, it crossed Florida, picked up strength over the Gulf of Mexico, and made landfall in southeast Louisiana on August 29th. While Katrina's 125-mile-per-hour winds, sending beds flying out of hotel windows, and 10 inches of rain were bad enough, a storm surge of more than 28 feet devastated the Mississippi coastal cities of Gulfport and Biloxi. But the greatest damage was reserved for the region's largest city, New Orleans. Nicknamed the Big Easy, most of New Orleans is below sea level. Under Katrina's onslaught, levees that were supposed to protect the city gave way in more than 50 places, and 80% of the city was flooded. While most of New Orleans' 1.2 million residents were evacuated, many to the city of Houston, Texas, thousands either refused to leave or could not. The disaster claimed more than 1,800 lives and destroyed 200,000 homes. Damage estimates ranged as high as $125 billion, making it the most expensive hurricane in U.S. history. It wasn't until October 11th that the last of the floodwaters were pumped out. Remember, by then, a hurricane of criticism had whipped up over the federal government's response to the disaster. The criticism ranged from condemning the government's slow response in some areas with regard to the evacuation process to providing adequate temporary housing after the storm. There were also charges that the slow response was due in part to the fact that many of New Orleans' residents were poor African Americans. Bush's approval rating sank to the lowest of his presidency, but they would go even lower. Ike hits Texas. In September 2008, New Orleans was again evacuated when threatened by Hurricane Gustav. This time, the preparations and responses were better, and the levees held. But on the heels of Gustav came Ike. The hurricane hit the Gulf Coast of Texas on September 13th, dragging up a massive storm surge that drowned much of the city of Galveston. The storm killed 82 in the United States, with as many as 200 people missing, and did an estimated $27 billion worth of property damage. Once again, the federal government was criticized for its post-storm performance. Texas officials complained that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, had been slow to provide housing for those left homeless by the hurricane and to provide funds for cleaning up the mess. The response from Washington has been pretty underwhelming, Texas Governor Rick Perry said in mid-November, 2 months after the storm. This is really irritating. But hurricanes, and even irritated governors, paled in the face of another kind of storm, an economic tempest that enveloped the nation and most of the rest of the world. Chapter 22. Recessions can be really depressing. In this chapter, popping economic bubbles filled with dot-coms and houses. Losing jobs and not finding them again. Concocting cures for an ailing economy. Carving a larger piece of the economic pie for a smaller percentage of Americans. An old economist's joke, told mainly by old economists, says that a recession is when your neighbor loses his job, and a depression is when you lose yours. Whatever you call it, the country's unsettled financial situation as the new century unfolded permeated nearly every aspect of Americans' lives, from politics to lifestyles, to how Americans got along with the rest of the world and one another. In this chapter, I look at the web of elements that ensnared the economy, the impacts that technology, global competition, and corporate profits had on employment, the government's efforts to fix things, and the growing gap between the very richest Americans and everyone else. Ouch! The economy stubs its toe. Here's what happened to the U.S. economy in the first years of the 21st century. A lot of people got rich, and then poor, creating and/or investing in high-tech companies. Then, people in California bought homes they couldn't afford. And then Iceland went broke, and thus America had what has been called the Great Recession. Of course, that interpretation is way too simple. There really isn't a linear cause-effect explanation. The recession was actually a lot of causes and effects linked together. Think of it as sort of a spider's web of events and results. Dot-com dreams and investor nightmares. As the 20th century ended and the 21st century began, there was an explosion of technological innovation, much of it centering on the Internet. This innovation was heralded as the gateway to a new economy, based on information sharing as much as producing goods and services. And it triggered what was labeled the dot-com boom. Investors poured millions of dollars into hundreds of companies that were founded on great ideas, but that often lacked sound business plans, large potential markets, and in some cases, even a product or service to sell. This situation was an example of what Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, had labeled in 1996 as irrational exuberance, when investors' enthusiasm to make dollars overwhelms their common sense. By March 2001, the dot-com bubble had burst. Scores of companies went belly up, their stocks became worthless, and America had its first economic recession in a decade. The terrorist attacks on September 11th of that year also dealt a sharp blow to the economy. The dot-com bubble-bursting recession was fairly mild, but some economists were still troubled. Although the overall economy began improving by the end of 2001, unemployment rates that had risen when the recession began stubbornly refused to go down again to anything near their previous levels. The houses that went upside down. A much nastier recession, in fact the worst the country had suffered since the Great Depression of the 1930s, began with another bubble bursting in late 2007. This one was centered on the American dream of owning your own home and came about partly because of something called credit default swaps. Under federal law, banks and other lending institutions have to keep lots of capital in reserve to protect investors if any of the big loans the lenders make go bad. To free up those reserves so they can be used to turn a profit elsewhere, the lending industry came up with a sort of insurance policy in the 1990s called a credit default swap. It involved having a third party, individual investors, insurance companies, hedge funds, and so on, assume the risk of a loan going bad in return for regular payments from the firm that had actually made the loan. The federal government didn't regulate the deals, so no one had a good handle on how widespread they were or which companies and economic sectors were most at risk. By the middle of the decade, the arrangements had morphed into more than $60 trillion, that's trillion with a T, of swaps, and banks and other lenders had trillions of dollars to lend to people who, say, wanted to buy a house. Buying up houses. In the late 1990s, interest rates were low, and real estate was an attractive investment. Americans began buying homes like crazy. Annual U.S. home sales set records for 5 straight years, peaking at 7.5 million in 2005. The greater the demand, the higher real estate prices went. Average home prices soared from less than $200,000 in 2000 to more than $300,000 in 2007. But as prices climbed, fewer people could qualify for mortgage loans, at least under traditional methods of measuring qualifications, such as whether the borrower had enough income to make the payments. So lenders and mortgage brokers got creative. They pushed loans with no down payments, loans that started out with low interest rates and then ballooned after a few years, and loans on which the borrower paid only interest for the first few years. By 2005, more than 200 kinds of mortgage products were available. And if there came a time when the borrowers couldn't meet the mortgage payments, heck, they could just refinance or sell the house for more than they paid for it and walk away with a profit. The risky mortgages boomed for about $160 billion in 2001 to more than $600 billion 4 years later. There was even a bonus for people who could afford their mortgage payments. Their homes became giant piggy banks. They could borrow on the equity in their homes and buy a new car or pay for juniors' college. And flipping, buying a house, fixing it up and reselling it for hefty profits, became a hip way to get rich quick, as long as prices kept rising. Meanwhile, the new mortgages were pooled and sold by the lenders as investment bonds to commercial banks, mutual funds, pension funds, and investors all over the world. And the bonds were insured by credit default swaps issued by many of Wall Street's largest financial institutions. Defaults and foreclosures. The housing market was fine for a while, but then it cooled off. Big time. Sales of all homes sagged from a record 7.5 million in 2005 to an estimated 4.9 million in 2008, a 35% drop. Sales of brand new homes dropped even more precipitously, from more than 1.2 million in 2005 to slightly more than 300,000 by 2011. Millions found their gimmicky mortgages had caught up with them. They couldn't make their payments, and they owed more than they could sell their houses for, hence the term upside-down mortgages. So they defaulted. Big time. Between July and September 2008 alone, foreclosure notices were sent to 766,000 U.S. homes. A quarter of those were in California, where housing prices had climbed the fastest and came down the same way. Median housing prices across the nation dropped about 10% in 2008 compared to 2007, and more than 30% in California. Mortgage-based bonds went in the tank, and big lenders faced making good on hundreds of billions of dollars in credit default swaps. Some couldn't, and they declared bankruptcy or were bought up by other firms. Depression? Recession? Broke? Never mind the old economist joke at the beginning of this chapter. Here's a more technical explanation of the difference between a recession and a depression. An economic recession occurs when a country's gross domestic product, GDP, that's the value of all the country's reported goods and services, goes down for 2 consecutive quarters, 6 consecutive months, or more. A depression happens when the GDP drops by 10% or more. During America's Great Depression, which stretched over a decade, the GDP dropped a whopping 27% between 1929 and 1933, and another 18% between 1937 and 1938. In contrast, in the new century's worst year, 2008, the GDP decreased only 2.8%. In fact, the Great Recession officially only lasted from December 2007 to June 2009, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the private, nonprofit organization of economists that has kept official track of such things since 1920. Still, the Great Recession of 2007 is considered by most economists to be the worst of the 10 recessions America has suffered since World War II because of its duration, worldwide scope, and stubborn refusal to go away and take all its effects and impacts with it. Credit dries up, spending shrinks, Iceland sinks. As the financial institutions foundered, lending dried up in other parts of the economy, from car loans to credit card limits. People who had relied on equity in their homes to pay for their boats or college tuition suddenly had no equity. So consumer spending shrunk, which caused businesses to cut back, often resulting in massive layoffs. The nation's unemployment rate doubled, from 5% in January 2008 to 10% in October 2009. At one point, an average of 750,000 people per month were losing their jobs. And because the U.S. market was the dominant force in the world economy, other countries felt the pain. In Iceland, for example, the government was forced to nationalize the country's 3 major banks. The banks relied heavily on foreign investment. When the world's credit markets became tight, the Icelandic banks ran short on funds to meet their obligations. And it wasn't just Iceland. The recession spread around the world, which in turn meant less foreign investment and business for the United States. Brother, can you spare a job? The most vexing effect of the Great Recession was its swollen jobless numbers. Prior to December 2008, America's monthly unemployment rate had not been above 7% since June 1993. From December 2008 through November 2013, however, it never went below 7.3%. And that figure didn't include Americans who were underemployed and could find only part-time work or who gave up looking altogether. People were out of work longer. New jobs were being created at a frustratingly slow pace, and many companies found they could make do with fewer employees. Looking for work and looking. In November 2013, the New York Times ran a story about a 53-year-old Massachusetts woman who had been unemployed most of the time since 2008. A college graduate, she had been turned down for dozens of low-paying, low-skill positions for reasons that included too pretty, too articulate, and because we don't hire the unemployed. She was far from alone in her lengthy quest for work. By November 2013, more than 4 million people, defined as the long-term unemployed, had been out of work for longer than 26 weeks. That was triple the number of long-term jobless before the recession began, and 50% more than the highest figure in any of America's other recessions since World War II. In July 2008, Congress approved extending unemployment benefits from 26 weeks to as long as 99 weeks and subsequently approved further extensions. But the extensions came with a $250 billion price tag, and there was growing congressional opposition to continuing the program indefinitely. Some economists suggested extending benefits had exacerbated the problem by serving as an incentive for the jobless people not to actively seek work and a disincentive for employers to create new jobs. Where the work went. An estimated 9.1 million jobs had either been lost or not created as expected during the Great Recession and its aftermath. To create enough new jobs to replace them required plugging the holes through which they had leaked. One of the holes was outsourcing, or the transfer of jobs by American companies to other countries with lower costs of doing business. The Department of Commerce reported that from 2000 to 2012, the largest U.S. multinational corporations cut their domestic workforces by 2.9 million while increasing their foreign payrolls by 2.4 million. The outsourcing issue was hotly debated during the 2012 presidential race, with each candidate accusing the other of supporting the practice. Many of the outsourced jobs were in manufacturing. Between 2000 and 2009, about 6 million U.S. factory jobs were lost, and only 520,000 had been recovered. Technological changes and automation also contributed to the loss. Costs of providing benefits, such as meeting new federal health care mandates, were also a factor in reduced payrolls. For more on this subject, see Chapter 23. Employers with more than 49 workers faced fines if they didn't provide health care to full-time employees. Some companies responded by cutting workers to part-time status, or just cutting workers. Another key factor was cutbacks by state and local governments. In previous recessions, public agencies had been quicker than the private sector to restore jobs. But by the end of 2013, state and local governments and schools still employed about 600,000 fewer people than they had 4 years earlier. And as the recession waned, many companies found they could make more money by sharing less of it with employees. As workers scrambled to hold on to their jobs, forget about asking for a raise, productivity increased, which enabled employers to get by with fewer employees. A 2010 Northeastern University study found that while pre-tax corporate profits increased 57% from the end of 2008 to the beginning of 2010, wages decreased 2%. By the end of 2012, U.S. corporations had amassed a record $1.45 trillion in cash reserves, more than half of it stashed overseas to avoid U.S. taxes. As the recession slowly eased, some of the jobs came back, and some didn't. An estimated 1.5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs that existed in 2007, for example, no longer existed in 2017. Moreover, some of the people who couldn't find work just gave up looking altogether. The country's labor participation level, the number of people working or actively seeking jobs, dropped from 67% in 2007 to 63% in 2018. On the other hand, America's public sector workforce returned to its pre-recession level, and an average of 208,000 new jobs were created per month during the first 9 months of 2018. But many of the new jobs were in industries that provided services, retail stores, restaurants, hotels. Those jobs generally paid less and provided fewer benefits than manufacturing jobs. We're here from the government. We're here to help. Perhaps because of lessons learned from the Great Depression of the 1930s, the federal government reacted quickly, if somewhat reluctantly, to the financial calamity. The U.S. Treasury Department seized the government-backed mortgage finance firms known as Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The government also bailed out American International Group, AIG, the nation's largest insurance company, but allowed Lehman Brothers, one of the country's largest savings and loan firms, to crash into bankruptcy. On September 24, 2008, with his approval ratings wallowing below 30%, President Bush warned a national television audience that the entire economy is in danger. The speech was part of an effort to sell Congress on a plan to bail out the teetering financial industry. Known as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, the plan was to use $700 billion in taxpayer money to buy up the mortgage-backed securities of floundering financial institutions. Without immediate action by Congress, America could slip into a financial panic, Bush said, and a distressing scenario could unfold. The scenario did unfold 5 days later when a defiant House of Representatives rejected the Bush proposal. The U.S. stock market reacted with the biggest one-day point drop in its history. 2 days later, the House reversed itself and approved a version of the bailout plan that the Senate had revised. The plan gave Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson wide latitude to use the money to shore up financial and mortgage institutions. But to work, it would take time, and the bad economic news just kept coming. Toward the end of November, the stock market had sunk to its lowest level in more than a decade, dragging down pension plans and individual retirement accounts with it. The crash dashed the dreams of millions of baby boomers, those born from 1946 through 1964, many of whom had counted on cashing in on healthy stock prices and soaring home values to finance an early retirement. Now, they were desperately hoping to hold on to their jobs. Brand new president, same old problems. In January 2009, President Bush handed off the crisis to his successor, Barack Obama. For the lowdown on Obama and the 2008 presidential campaign, see Chapter 23. Less than a month later, the new Democratic president and a Democrat-controlled Congress agreed to a sweeping and expensive plan to revive the economy and get as much of the country back to work as possible. Remember, the plan, known formally as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 and informally as the Stimulus Package, called for spending $787 billion, which eventually climbed to $831 billion, on a combination of tax incentives, direct aid to states and local governments, public works projects, extensions of unemployment benefits and funding for job training, and infusions of cash for education, health care, housing, energy, and other programs. The immediate goals of the act were to save jobs and create new ones, help prop up state and local government programs and services, such as those for public safety and education, and inject capital directly into the economy for public works projects that would encourage private investment. The Act's economic philosophy was rooted in the theories of John Maynard Keynes, a British economist who had been greatly influential in guiding the New Deal policies of President Franklin D. Roosevelt during the Great Depression. Keynes had argued that when recessions cause private spending to shrink, governments should spend more to make up the difference, combat unemployment, and prevent the economy from further decline. "Today does not mark the end of our economic troubles," Obama said while signing the act in Denver on February 17, 2009. "Nor does it constitute all of what we must do to turn our economy around, but it does mark the beginning of the end." As it turned out, the stimulus package wasn't a bad financial investment. Of the $631.4 billion in the package that consisted of loans or investments, the federal government got back $728.5 billion in refunds, dividends, and interest, for a profit of $97.1 billion. But by itself, it wasn't enough to right the economic ship. Buying time by buying bonds. While the President and Congress were busy with bailouts and job saving, another branch of the federal government was also looking for ways to keep U.S. finances afloat. First, some explanation. Congress created the Federal Reserve System in 1913, in essence, to function as the federal government's bank and oversee U.S. monetary policy. Among other things, the Fed sets the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate banks charge one another for short-term loans and which influences the rates of almost all other kinds of loans. That comes in handy during recessions because lower interest rates help keep the economy moving. The Fed can also influence the nation's money supply by buying or selling securities, such as government bonds. If it wants to increase the amount of available money in recessionary times, for example, it buys bonds by crediting the reserves various banks must have on hand. That lets the banks lower their reserves and use the money to make money through loans and investments. When the Great Recession hit, the Fed wielded its financial tools with frequency. Starting in late 2007, it cut the federal funds rate 9 times in 15 months, dropping the rate from 4.75% to near zero, the lowest in its history. Moreover, it went on a bond-buying spree, averaging $85 billion a month by late 2013. Overall, the Fed's balance sheet rose from about $900 billion in mid-2008 to more than $3.7 trillion by the beginning of 2014. These purchases have made a meaningful contribution to economic growth and improving the outlook, Federal Reserve Board Vice Chairman Janet Yellen told a congressional committee in November 2013. A strong recovery will ultimately enable the Fed to reduce its monetary accommodation and reliance on unconventional policy tools such as asset purchases. I believe that supporting the recovery today is the surest path to returning to a more normal approach to monetary policy. Did government intervention work? The answer to the question, did government intervention work, is clear. It depends on whom you ask. Even before much of the Bush-Obama plans were put in place, or the Federal Reserve System's actions had taken hold, there was deeply divided debate on what kind of lifeline could rescue America's economy. A few weeks before the stimulus plan was approved, for example, a group of about 200 economists took out ads in national newspapers opposing it. A week after that, a similar-sized group of economists sent a letter to Congress endorsing the plan. All of which brings to mind the famous quote by President Harry Truman, "Give me a one-handed economist. All my economists say, on the one hand, on the other." Some studies have suggested that the efforts saved or created more than 3 million jobs while keeping inflation in check. Other studies concluded they were only temporary fixes that would do more harm than good in the long run or had little effect. Some liberal economists contended that the efforts didn't go far enough and even more government spending was needed. Conservatives argued that the recession would have waned without the stimulus plan, and the biggest result of the plan was to increase the size of the federal budget debt. Moreover, they warned, the free money policies of the Fed had pumped up stock prices to unsustainable levels and would trigger high inflation down the road. As it turned out, at least through the end of 2018, the lasting impacts of both the Great Recession and the efforts to defeat it were decidedly, indisputably, and unreservedly mixed. The stock market enjoyed a 9-year positive run that was unprecedented in modern times for its longevity. Yet it took a decade for the median household income, the amount at which half of U.S. households make more and half make less, to return to its 2007 level. Home foreclosure actions dropped from a peak of more than 200,000 in 2009 to less than 31,000 in 2017. But the percentage of Americans who owned homes also dropped. the nation's unemployment rate dropped from 10% in October 2009 to around 4% by October 2018. And yet total household debt had climbed $500 billion higher than its peak in 2008. The annual inflation rate dropped from 3.8% in 2008 to 2.2% in 2018, while the percentage of Americans living below the poverty level, a number set annually by the federal government to determine eligibility for various safety net programs, slightly rose. So, 10 years after the start of the worst economic collapse since the 1930s, many Americans were back to making the same amount of money. More of them were working. Fewer of them owned homes but were less likely to lose them if they did. And while prices were going up more slowly, more poor people couldn't afford to buy much anyway. Unspreading the wealth. The first two decades of the 21st century weren't painful for all Americans. Those with a substantial part of their money in assets and other real estate, and a substantial enough pile of dough to ride out the rough times,